The fundamental question of how so many of the nation's leading televangelists, mega church pastors, and other influential faith leaders fell in lockstep behind the improbable presidential campaign of one Donald J. Trump and have stayed there, scandal after scandal, through impeachment and now through a failed effort to contain a pandemic that has claimed an unthinkable 100,000 innocent American lives, desperately needs to be answered. And answering it requires the kind of insights and understanding that few thinkers and writers possess. Thankfully, the unholy alliance of the political religious right and nakedly partisan priorities has been in the crosshairs for investigative journalist Sarah Posner for many years. She sounded an urgent warning in her 2008 book, God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. And she now has published a timely and comprehensive new volume titled Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. This is a much-needed deep dive into the existential question of our age. And I am delighted that it brings my friend and colleague, Sarah Posner, back to State of Belief Radio. Sarah, congratulations on the book, and thank you so much for being with us again.
Of course, for having me, Welton.
You recount the chilling story of being leaked a draft executive order that seemed to reorient the very relationship between church and state in our nation. That was a pretty solid early warning of what was coming, wasn't it?
It was. This was just a couple of weeks into Trump's presidency back in 2017. I was leaked a draft executive order, which read to me like a wish list of what the Christian right had been advocating for and lobbying for years. Basically, wide open religious exemptions for conservative Christians who objected to LGBTQ rights, reproductive rights. And the way it was drafted, it could have been read to allow discrimination not just against women and LGBTQ people, but against other people for basically any quote unquote religious reason. This was shocking on one level that so early in the Trump presidency that they were going to try to basically run over civil rights laws via executive order. But now looking back on it, I guess it doesn't seem so shocking that this would be the method by which they would try to do it. Now, Trump never signed that particular executive order, even though he was strongly urged to by his Christian right allies. But the Trump administration has chipped away in many other ways at LGBTQ rights and reproductive rights and expanded the religious rights for conservative Christians that in other ways, using other mechanisms. But that executive order, which was handed to me in January 2017, actually turned out to be pretty much a roadmap for what they wanted to do.
What are some of the promises the campaign offered the theocratic right that cemented the kind of loyalty many of us have been puzzled by during the administration?
Well, I think the important thing to understand about the way Trump's primary campaign went in 2016 was that the white evangelical base was ahead of the white evangelical leadership in supporting Trump. They were clearly moved by his campaign rallies, his bombast, his racism, and there were a lot of elite influential power broker types in the Christian right who were not yet backing Trump. They were backing Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz or staying neutral in the race. Mm-hmm. But over time, they began to see that the base, that Trump was the one that the base wanted. And we can get into the reasons why that happened. But as it became evident that the leadership was going to pretty much start following the base, they extracted promises from Trump in exchange for their support, which obviously, even with the base's support, it's important to have the support of the power brokers, of the influential leaders. Yeah. And those promises pretty much centered on judges promising Supreme Court justices who would overturn Roe, other federal court judges who would support their concept of religious freedom, and promises to staff his agencies and White House with other Christian right ideologues and loyalists who would govern from this quote unquote biblical point of view.
Mm-hmm. Would you say they've been able to achieve their most important goals successfully, or have the constitutional structures of our republic been able to resist at least some of the changes they wanted to make?
Well, I think that in some cases they have been successful. In some cases they've been successful by abusing the procedural mechanisms that are in place, for example, abusing procedural mechanisms in place to establish a process for revoking or reversing a federal regulation, for example. They've shortcutted that in a number of instances. I think the important thing to understand in this interplay between policy initiatives that they attempt to undertake and constitutional challenges to them is that simultaneously, the federal bench is being stacked with Mitch McConnell's help with judges who are more receptive to this point of view. So, for example, a case that's before the Supreme Court right now involves religious objections to foster care placement with same-sex couples, you know, so a religious foster care agency doesn't want to place children with a same-sex couple. This is a flashpoint for the Christian right. If the Supreme Court were to rule in their favor, that would be a huge victory for them. And even though, constitutionally speaking, you wouldn't, constitutional scholars would look at it based on previous court precedent and say, I don't think it would come out in their favor. But now the court has Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, you know, instead of Merrick Garland and somebody else. Yeah. And so it's conceivable that that case could come out in their favor. So I think you can't look at the policy initiatives or efforts in a vacuum from the courts.
I think it's easy to think of the promises as crassly calculated political manipulation, but it goes deeper, doesn't it? There really are some true believers at work behind some of this stuff.
Right. I think one thing that's important to understand about the Trump Christian right alliance is that some of it is transactional politics, right? So you have somebody like Tony Perkins or Ralph Reed, one of these people who leads a political organization. Tony Perkins leads the Family Research Council. Ralph Reed leads the Faith and Freedom Coalition. They meet frequently with Trump. They talk frequently with Trump. They're able to extract these promises because they are able to signal to the base whether they should be supporting Trump or not supporting Trump. But they are obviously signaling they should be supporting Trump. That's one level at which this support for Trump goes on. But there's another level that I think is less understood by people because it's less visible to us news consumers who are not as enmeshed in the evangelical subculture of televangelism and the prosperity gospel and this idea that, this movement of like self-proclaimed apostles and prophets who think that they are getting revelations from God about Trump and what God is doing with Trump. And so within that subculture, the support for Trump is less an analysis of these political considerations and more of a divine revelation. Trump is God's hand is on Trump. God wants Trump in office at this time for America. Trump is ordained by God. Trump is anointed by God. He's like King Cyrus in the Bible. And it's much harder to analyze that kind of support from a political point of view because it's just so deeply rooted in this subculture where it's completely normal and accepted to believe that God would be anointing political leaders and saving America from liberalism or saving America from political correctness or George Soros or whatever the conspiracy theory is.
There are certainly important distinctions between the American religious right and white nationalists. I think the latter have benefited in countless ways from the policies aimed at appeasing the former. But is that just coincidence, or has there actually been a deliberate effort made to woo those darker forces?
So there was no evidence that someone like Tony Perkins, who runs probably the most prominent religious right organization, the Family Research Council, met with Richard Spencer, probably one of the country's most prominent white nationalists. Oh. In fact, I would think there was a lot of antipathy between those two men. I've never asked Tony Perkins about Richard Spencer, but I've asked Richard Spencer about Tony Perkins, and they don't see each other as allies. And I'm certain that Tony Perkins would not want to be seen at a Tiki Torch march or at a conference where people were giving the Hitler salute. But the Christian right, the religious right, stood by as Trump winked and nodded at white nationalists, said that there were good, very fine people on both sides in Charlottesville. All of these dalliances that Trump had with white nationalists were pretty much left uncriticized by the religious right, pretty much throughout his primary campaign and definitely throughout his presidency. On the other hand, there is evidence that people within the Trump campaign were knowledgeable about the need to bring these two together. When I interviewed Steve Bannon at the Republican National Convention back in 2016, which was about a month before he was brought onto the Trump campaign, he told me point blank that you would need an alliance of the Christian right and the alt-right in order to win the election. I mean, he was pretty much basically telling me his number-crunching strategy. And as I discuss in a lot more detail in the book, this did not just happen by happenstance in the Trump era. There's a lot of sort of rooted common history where race is a very critical issue in the formation of the Christian right back in the 1970s. And so all of this needs to be understood in that historical context as well.
Yeah. Sarah, we all know public policy is sterile and abstract until it is implemented. And then it impacts countless lives in sometimes unpredictable ways. So could you talk about some of the real life ways that the religious rights playbook is affecting us right now?
Well, for example, Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos has said she's going to order public schools to give some of the money that they've received under the COVID stimulus to private schools, including private religious schools. That's one big glaring example. Right now, churches across the country are engaged in litigation and kind of litigation in the court of public opinion about whether stay-at-home orders and bans on large gatherings during this pandemic violate their religious freedom. And they have attracted not only Trump's attention, because we all know that Trump talked about how he wanted to order the governors to let the churches reopen, but it has also got the attention of the Justice Department, where Attorney General Bill Barr has spoken on the issue and has authorized a team of lawyers to intervene in some of these cases on behalf of the churches, not on behalf of the governors trying to keep the residents of their state safe, but on behalf of the churches who insist that it's a violation of their religious rights to have to comply with these stay-at-home orders. Those are just two examples that are pandemic related. And then there are a lot more that are not pandemic related, such as the Department of Health and Human Services undermining rules enacted in the Obama era to protect beneficiaries of government-funded programs from religious discrimination. So discrimination based on their sexual orientation or gender identity, or based on their marital status or what have you, but basically expanding the ability of taxpayer-funded organizations who provide social services to many needy people across the country, basically reopening their ability to discriminate based on religion.
Sarah, the recent confession by the woman known as Jane Roe in the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court case that she manufactured her public change of heart and anti-abortion activism thanks to hundreds of thousands of religious right dollars made me think of the confluence of money and theocratic politics that you analyze so astutely. Is this a one-off, or do we need to be less naive about other public testimonies and campaigns that may well be bought and paid for?
It's a really interesting question, because I really believe that the religious right really thrives on these conversion stories, right? They love the story of somebody who was once on the dark side and they saw the light, and they came over to the side of righteousness and Jesus, basically. It's fascinating with regard to Jane Roe. I mean, I had no idea about this until, and I haven't seen the film yet, but, you know, obviously read about it. These kinds of stories really fuel the narrative that the Christian right likes to tell, that anybody can be redeemed as long as you come over to our side. And our side is the side of righteousness and virtue and purity. And so, but it doesn't look so pure now that we know this about Jane Roe.
Many of the people that you write about are individuals that I dealt with early in my career. When you compare the early leaders of the Christian right with current leaders, are the people causing trouble now smarter, more politically adept than the first group? And I guess what I'm getting at with that question is the religious right at a place where it will be strong regardless of who's in the White House?
Yes. The short answer is yes. They will be strong regardless of who is in the White House. They're strong right now in a certain way because Trump has given them a great deal of leeway and basically a carte blanche to run his administration, to help pick judges, to basically dictate policy, but not just dictate policy, but to also dictate the narrative and the story and the drama around Trump. I mean, just today, the Christian Broadcasting Network ran an exclusive interview with Kayleigh McEnany, his new press secretary, glorifying and elevating her religious belief and her faith in Jesus and her salvation story, as if like that is the most important criteria or prerequisite to be the White House press secretary. But I think in a lot of ways, the history that I go over in and reveal in the book is very instructive about the staying power of the Christian right. Because a lot of the history that I uncovered in my research sounds a lot like something that could happen today. So for example, Robert Billings, who was possibly more instrumental in forming the modern religious right with Paul Weyrich than, say, Jerry Falwell Sr. was. And I would urge people to read the book to find out more about why I say that. But he became an official in the Department of Education under President Reagan. And it was discovered while he was serving in the Department of Education that he touted himself as a Christian school educator. He was a principal and a headmaster of various Christian schools, and he was basically a leader in the Christian school movement. And it turned out, it was discovered after he became an official in the United States government, that his PhD was from a diploma mill. And I remember reading that as I was doing the research for this book and thinking, that sounds so Trumpian. It sounds like exactly like something that would happen under Trump. Some guy gets installed at the Department of Education and it turns out he has a PhD from a diploma mill.
Does this mean that the historical period that we're talking about, were there things in it, warnings that we should have heeded that might have helped us take a different direction?
Well, yes. I think that that's always true. Like, you know, in hindsight, you could look at things as being warnings and you should take a different direction. But mostly when you're looking back at this history, I mean, from my perspective, it's really more instructive in terms of how did we get here? Not what was the road not taken. And like I said, I think people should read the book because I go into a fair amount of detail about this, yeah. But the Christian right's antipathy towards the government doing anything that helps promote human dignity, civil rights, pluralism, a liberal democracy was evident in its early days. And when I say its early days, I'm talking about the late 60s, early 70s, you know, before what we think of as the formation of the modern religious right with the launch of the Moral Majority in 1979. And really what was driving them was not the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade in 1973, but the notion that the federal government wanted to play a role in ensuring that private Christian schools were not discriminating against Black students.
Yeah.
And this was their big crusade against the federal government. And when you look at that with historical hindsight, you see not only how much race was a factor and the sense of grievance that something was being taken away from them, but also the sense that the federal government trying to do something about race discrimination was equal to their religious rights being infringed upon, which I think is really instructive for what we're seeing now.
What's next? What's the call to action that comes out of the reporting that you've done in this important book and elsewhere? Because I refuse to believe that it's too late if enough people heed the warning.
Well, I think people really have to understand that Trump is not some weird aberration that just came out of nowhere and can be vanquished because there are a lot of anti-Trump conservatives who are very prominent on Twitter or on your TV, on CNN or MSNBC, that this is a political movement that has been aiming for a moment like this for a long time. Maybe they didn't envision Trump himself with all of his personal and sexual scandals, but they did envision having somebody who would snub his nose at liberal democracy, at civil rights, at the idea that America is a pluralistic, religiously pluralistic nation. And so There's a lot at stake here because Trump has taken their support and their unwillingness to question him and the unwillingness of the Republican Party to question him to expand presidential power to unprecedented extremes. So this election is not just about a Republican versus a Democrat. This election is about whether we're going to have a liberal democracy or not.
Sarah Posner is a reporting fellow with Type Investigations, a prolific writer at the intersection of politics and religion. Sarah has just published her latest book titled Unholy: Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. Sarah, this is such an important and timely work. I know many people will benefit from reading it. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you.